Kurzer Hinweis vorweg. Diese Folge ist auf Englisch und wurde mit einer KI generiert.
For 12 days, Israel and Iran exchanged rocket fire. For 12 days, war returned to the Middle East. Another violent escalation in a region already marked by numerous smaller conflicts. A ceasefire is now in effect between the two countries. But what remains? What impact have the past 12 days had on people in Israel? What have they gone through? And how do they reflect on the recent escalation? What hopes or fears shape their view of what lies ahead? These are the central themes explored in this episode of In Crisis Mode, the podcast that brings voices from the world's crisis and conflict zones.
In Crisis Mode, the podcast from Conflict Zones with Jan Jessen.
Hello, I'm Jan Jessen. I'm the head of politics at the NRZ and a war and crisis reporter for the Funke Media Group. You can read my reports in the NRZ, WRZ, the Berliner Morgenpost, the Hamburger Abendblatt, and of course on all our online platforms. I just returned from a trip to Israel and the West Bank. I arrived there after the war, which, well, I know this may sound a bit cynical, but from a reporter's perspective, it was a little unfortunate. Before that, I had been in Afghanistan for 2 weeks. By the way, we'll also be covering that trip in one of our upcoming podcast episodes. Anyway, I traveled to Israel following the American strikes on Iran's nuclear program. I thought we were on the brink of a massive escalation, that things were really about to explode. That's why I went. But then, unexpectedly, a ceasefire was declared. So, I didn't witness any active combat while I was there. But I did speak with people who had just lived through it. People who were clearing the rubble and trying to return to something resembling normal life. In previous podcast episodes, we've also talked about the situation in Gaza, where the war continues with relentless brutality. Now, for over 630 days. At the same time, Israeli military operations are ongoing in the West Bank, in southern Syria, and not least in Lebanon. So while there may be a truce between Israel and Iran, many of these conflict hotspots continue to smolder. We also spoke in a previous episode with Carlo Masala, a military expert and political scientist from the Bundeswehr University in Munich. He helped us put the Iran-Israel conflict into geopolitical context. You can still listen to that episode. We'll link it in the show notes so you can catch up. Now, as I said, things have moved on a bit. The major conflict with Iran, the mutual bombardment with ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and of course drones, has come to a temporary halt. You could really feel that in Israel. I entered the country on the very day the ceasefire was announced, because the airspace was still closed. I couldn't fly into Tel Aviv directly, into Ben Gurion Airport. So I had to enter via Jordan. It was a bit of an adventurous journey, but it worked out in the end. When I arrived, people were just starting to catch their breath again. On that first day, you could still feel the tension. People were wary, unsure whether the ceasefire would hold. The streets of Tel Aviv, which is usually a buzzing, vibrant city on the Mediterranean, Israel's party capital and its secular heart, were noticeably quieter. Traffic was lighter than usual. The beaches weren't nearly as full as they normally are. You could sense the skepticism. Millions of Israelis had spent the days of the war in bunkers and safe rooms, trying to stay protected from Iranian missile strikes. I then traveled to Beersheba in southern Israel. Just minutes before the ceasefire officially took effect, a ballistic missile from Iran struck a residential building there. 4 people were killed, again, mere minutes before the truce began. Near the ruins of that building, I met Ido, a 23-year-old volunteer with OneHAR, a kind of civilian emergency aid organization, somewhat comparable to Germany's THW, though not as technically equipped. These are people who respond after bombings or other disasters, helping clear debris and providing assistance. During the Iranian attacks, they went into destroyed homes to help people clean up and tried to offer emotional support. Ido told me in detail what exactly they do in those moments.
Yeah, we came into the apartments who got hit. Usually not the apartment, the building who got hit, but the area around. At least 500 meters around perimeter, there is damage. So we knock in the apartment, ask if they need help of evacuating the glasses, the maybe couches, tables, and everything else.
Idor and others are helping people whose homes were severely damaged, as he himself described. He's doing this on his own initiative. It's not something he's obligated to do, but rather an expression of civil society. And that spirit is very strong in Israel. Whenever something terrible happens, people step in to support one another. As Idor said, he's also doing it because he wants to give something back to his hometown.
They wanted a big and hurtful hit, the last hit. It's heartbreaking every time. Especially here in my hometown, it's just a shame that they're directing to a civilian area. The family was in the shelter. Mom, a kid, and the kid's girlfriends all vanished, all disappeared. And I know them, actually. Yes, my other daughter was in school with me, and she left alone. Yesterday, I've been in her funeral. Completely heartbreaking. It's terrible.
It's a major crisis for the people affected. I also spoke with two women standing in front of the wreckage. For them, it was clearly a traumatic moment. Israel has never experienced anything quite like this. Ballistic missiles with warheads weighing several hundred kilograms crashing into the heart of its cities. There have, of course, been repeated Katyusha rocket attacks from Gaza and occasionally ballistic missiles launched from Yemen, but the direct impact on civilian infrastructure in densely populated urban areas marks a new and bitter reality for many Israelis. That sense of shock was something I encountered again and again in my conversations. In Tel Aviv, I met Sharon, an architect who speaks fluent German. She told me that in the past, fear was never really part of everyday life. But now, the missile strikes have exposed just how vulnerable they truly are. The fact that these rockets landed right in the middle of city centers made that vulnerability impossible to ignore. One missile hit Tel Aviv's so-called White City, the cultural and architectural heart of the city. It's an area with more than 4,000 Bauhaus-style buildings designed by German-Jewish architects who emigrated before or during the Nazi rise to power. It's often referred to as Tel Aviv's German legacy. And that's exactly where the missile landed, on Pinsker Street, destroying several buildings and severely damaging dozens more. Sharon works for the city's preservation authority. As we walked through the devastated area, you could see the pain in her expression. Standing among the ruins, it was clear just how deeply affected she was.
Ich habe Bauchschmerzen. Genau, vor allem wir pflegen diese Häuser unglaublich. Also auch diese zwei Häuser gegenüber.
I just have stomach pain right now. Especially because we take such incredible care of these houses. Even the two across the street were just renovated, with an extra floor, with an elevator, with shelter rooms. This destruction can't be repaired. It's truly a loss. You lose a piece of history.
It may sound a little strange to call it a loss when buildings are destroyed, but for Sharon, it is. She's an architect working for the city's preservation authority, and what was damaged is part of Tel Aviv's historic heritage. For someone whose professional life is dedicated to preserving and maintaining these buildings, it's an especially bitter blow. It's important to remember how this conflict began. On Friday, June 13th, Israel launched a military operation with the declared aim of disabling Iran's nuclear program. The strikes came as a surprise, not least because negotiations on Iran's nuclear ambitions were still underway. Another round of talks had actually been scheduled for the Monday following the attack. Israel justified its actions by claiming Iran was only days away from developing a nuclear weapon, a weapon Israeli officials fear could be used against them. In their view, a nuclear-armed Iran would pose an existential threat, and they say that's why they launched a preemptive strike. That's a legally controversial move, as military analyst Carlo Massala confirmed in a previous episode of this podcast, which we've linked again in the show notes. But from the Israeli perspective, it was a matter of national defense. After all, Iran has repeatedly questioned Israel's right to exist, calling the country a Zionist entity that should be eliminated from the region. And so, on June 13th, Israel acted. The Iranian response was massive. More than 550 missiles and over 1,000 drones were launched toward Israel. While the country has one of the most advanced air defense systems in the world, a multi-layered shield, it didn't stop everything. The system includes Iron Dome for short-range rockets, David Sling for mid-range threats, and Arrow 3 for long-range ballistic missiles, like those coming from Iran. But even this sophisticated network couldn't intercept every projectile. Missiles struck not only Beersheba and Tel Aviv, but also cities like Bat Yam and Haifa. It was a level of vulnerability Israelis were not used to. Something Sharon mentioned again in our conversation. In the same street where I met her, I also spoke with Donna. She works for the Tel Aviv municipality and was part of the emergency response team supporting those affected by the strikes. We're in the center of Tel Aviv. An Iranian missile hit this street and damaged many buildings. Some were completely destroyed. The municipality set up what we call a street office so residents can come to us directly. We help them deal with bureaucracy and we offer emotional support. Many are now living in hotels. Not everyone is strong. Some people need help, some are afraid. But we try to stay optimistic.
Okay, so we're in the center of Tel Aviv, where a missile hit one of the streets, and an Iranian missile, and it affected many houses. Some of them destroyed completely. Some of them are still under evaluation to see if the tenants can go back and live there. And some of them had a minor effect, like glasses that broke, doors that came out. But again, the tenants doesn't live there. And now we are dealing with them, we're helping them, the municipality of Tel Aviv, establish some kind of a street office where they can come to us, talk to us directly. We try to help them with all the problems, bureaucracy, emotional things. A lot of them are in hotels. So we also help them if they need to move from one hotel to another, if they have a social problem, any kind of problem. We're trying to help whatever we can do. I mean, not all the people are strong. Some people need help. Some people have anxiety, which is, I mean, I understand that. But we're trying to be optimistic. We're trying to overcome it.
What Donna described, that people are trying to stay optimistic, is something you can genuinely feel in Israel. It's a striking trait, especially in Tel Aviv. The city is known as a hub of resilience, but also as Israel's secular heart, its party capital. There's always been something of a California vibe to it. People playing beach tennis or volleyball, lounging by the sea, enjoying life outdoors. And even now, despite the shock, you could sense a strong desire to return to normalcy. That includes trying to remain hopeful. I also spoke with a woman who didn't want to give her name. She was standing across the street, outside another street office, this one run by the city's tax authority. What she told me echoed what I'd heard from many Israelis over the past few days. We have to find a way to deal with the threat from Iran. We feel for the people there. They live under a terrible government, but we have to protect ourselves.
I think Israel must finish with this problem. Mm. We're sorry for the people there. They are poor people. We're very sorry for them. We understand they live in like bad situation with bad government. But and we hope that they're gonna have good days. what can we say?
What this woman essentially said was, we should have finished the job. And that, in her view, and in the view of many others I spoke with, is exactly what didn't happen. After long hesitation, the US did eventually join the Israeli operation against Iran. American B-2 bombers carried out strikes on suspected nuclear sites in Fordo, Natanz, and Isfahan, where Iran is believed to be developing its atomic infrastructure. But the operation didn't go entirely as planned. In typical fashion, Trump later declared that everything had been destroyed, that the damage was massive, and the nuclear program was over for good. Yet reports increasingly suggest that Fordow, considered the heart of Iran's nuclear program, was not fully destroyed. In fact, it may have suffered only surface-level damage. There's now concern that Iran could resume its nuclear efforts within a few months, if it ever truly stopped. That, too, remains uncertain. No one can say with absolute certainty that Iran is building a bomb. Everything points to it, but nothing is conclusive. And even if they had the bomb, no one can say for sure whether Iran would actually use it against Israel. Nuclear weapons are, after all, typically used as a strategic deterrent. Every nuclear-armed state so far, from Pakistan to India, China, France, the UK, the US, North Korea, and reportedly also Israel, has refrained from using them in war. The only exception remains the US in World War II. That's the paradox of nuclear weapons. They're built to prevent wars, not to fight them. In Iran, there are even fatwas, religious rulings, forbidding the possession or use of such weapons. But how much weight those hold is unclear. Ultimately, we just don't know. What is clear, however, is that the US attack was not as successful as Trump and his Defense Secretary Haxton claimed. In essence, not much has changed. Some facilities were hit. Israel did succeed in taking out many Iranian missile launchers, along with nuclear scientists, senior officers in the Revolutionary Guards, and intelligence officials. But the regime in Tehran is still standing, and there are growing indications that its nuclear program could resume sooner rather than later. That's what bothered this woman, and many others I spoke with. They told me, if we're going to strike, we should have seen it through. We should have finished it. Later in Tel Aviv, I met Emilia, a young woman who stood stunned in front of the damaged buildings. She told me she had lived in that neighborhood for 3 years and happened to be there the night the missile struck.
No, I was living here for 3 years in this neighborhood, and I've been here at night when everything happened. And it's hard. Mm. It's very hard, and it was the apartment of two of my friends who survived because of one was in Mamad in this time, and another one was with the parents in another city. So it's also a bit it's difficult to realize that it happened with my friends, and difficult to realize that it's my neighborhood. Mm. So I'm trying to not walk here a lot.
Luck, of course, plays a big part. Like what Emilia said, that by chance her friends simply weren't at home. The Israelis have another advantage compared to, say, the Iranians. They have a vast network of bomb shelters. It's mandatory for people to go into these shelters whenever there's an air raid alarm. These shelters are relatively safe. They won't withstand a direct hit. If a ballistic missile lands squarely on a building with a shelter inside, the shelter won't offer much protection. But they're very effective against smaller rockets like the Katyushas, fired from Gaza, shielding people from shrapnel and flying debris. If a rocket is shot down and fragments fall, shelters are a good defense against that too. And, as I said, despite these massive attacks, and I don't want to sound cynical, only 28 deaths is comparatively low given the scale of the bombardment Israel faced. Now, as I mentioned, there's a ceasefire between Israel and Iran, and whether it will hold, that's the big question. So far, things look promising, you have to say. But whether it lasts, nobody really knows. Even the people I spoke with on the ground weren't quite sure how to read the situation. For example, I met an older man, Motti Mantelkern was his name, who was nearly 80 years old. He briefly shared with me how he felt and what he thought about everything that's happening.
It's unbelievable and I have no words. They see Tel Aviv as if it were Berlin in 1945. It's not easy.
That's the Israeli perspective. But of course, and this must not be forgotten, there is also the Palestinian perspective. While the Iran-Israel conflict raged, the war in Gaza continued unabated. And not just Gaza, but military operations in the West Bank as well. It's not a formal state of war there, but the situation remains highly tense. As Western journalists, we unfortunately cannot enter Gaza freely, at least not in a way that allows independent reporting. The Israelis do not permit access for on-the-ground reporting, so we have to rely on accounts from people inside Gaza. We have repeatedly featured a young man from Gaza on this podcast who is critical of Hamas but also condemns the Israeli attacks. He told me again recently that he is unsure whether the ceasefire between Iran and Israel will actually bring calm to Gaza. Trump, the American president, wants peace now. But whether it will happen, as he envisions it, remains a big question. Meanwhile, in the West Bank, Israeli military operations are intensifying. There are increasing attacks by far-right Jewish settlers who are expanding their presence, building illegal settlements that violate international law, yet remain somewhat protected by the Israeli army. Shortly before this podcast was recorded, there was an incident where Jewish settlers attacked Israeli soldiers. This has become a major issue in Israel because it is deeply unsettling for the public when Israelis attack other Israelis. However, the group that has suffered the most from these clashes in recent months is the Palestinian civilian population. I spoke with some of them. I traveled to the West Bank, specifically to Sebastia, a small Christian village near Jenin. There, Palestinian refugees from the Jenin refugee camp have taken shelter. That camp is no longer a tent city, but has grown into a small town right next to Jenin. In January, people fled from that camp when the Israeli army moved in, suspecting terrorists from Hamas and Islamic Jihad. Fierce fighting broke out, and people fled. One of them is Anjad, whom I spoke with.
The attack, the Israeli army's assault on the refugee camp, was so brutal and intense. From the air and the ground, they attacked with helicopters and drones. I was sitting in the car with my son when 23 bullets hit the vehicle, and my son was struck by shrapnel in his head.
Now these people live in Sebastia, a town with 3,000 residents. In addition, 1,300 refugees have arrived. A stressful situation. Everyone there complains that hardly any aid is reaching them. Anjad made this very clear.
We only received 4 packages for 6 people. My wife and I have 5 children. That's never enough. We've been living here for 4 months. It's far too cramped.
I asked him if he was also angry at the armed militias in Jenin, who may have sparked the offensive. But he saw things differently.
I have the right to defend myself when you see an army attacking you.
His anger was mainly directed at the neighboring Arab states, which he feels have abandoned them. Then I asked how they experienced the Iran-Israel war. He replied, "We were glad to see rockets flying toward Israel. For the first time, they know what it feels like." What can you say? For me, it showed just how deeply divided things have become. In the West Bank, Israel plans to build 22 new settlements, despite international protests. This is likely to trigger resistance and possibly more violence. The refugees from Jenin, like Anjad and his family, face an uncertain future. Many are unemployed, and they cannot return, because part of the camp is scheduled for demolition. Meanwhile, in Israel, some normalcy is returning. Cafes in Tel Aviv are busy again, and the beaches are lively. Donna, a social worker in Tel Aviv, told me, "We just want a boring, normal life in a normal country. But Israel is far from that, and so is the whole region. Whether in Gaza, Syria, Lebanon, or the West Bank, tensions remain high. The war in Gaza continues, Hezbollah stays active, Hamas still holds hostages, and there are ongoing airstrikes, violence, and fear. No one knows if the ceasefire between Israel and Iran will last. Will new attacks happen? Will Iran retaliate again? I don't know. All I can say is that we all hope for Israelis, Palestinians, Iranians, Syrians, Lebanese, and Yemenis that peace will come, that they can finally live in peace. This was In Crisis Mode. This episode was produced by Alexander Baumeister, also a journalist with Funke Mediengruppe. If you enjoy our podcast, please subscribe, share, and send your feedback to krisenmodus@funkemedien.de. Thank you for listening. Stay safe.
Ein Podcast von Funke.